All right, it's another session of our new podcast.
Yeah,
we are so excited to have Matt Molyneux here. It's a big pleasure for me. So Matt is co-founder of Delegance. And I first met Matt back in 2012. We were both doing autonomy research. And I actually had found one of his papers first. He did some awesome work called Discover History, which is like causal explanations for things in when figuring out diagnosis for when autonomous systems fail. And this is like, you know, early 2010s, I think, or that this work was published.
I first published a Discover History paper in 2010.
Yeah. And so I read that as I was getting ready to go to grad school. And then we met and now we're, you know, 15 years later starting a company. It's so exciting.
Amazing. So yeah, I mean, you've been in the AI field, you know, before it was cool, I guess.
I've spent a bit more than 20 years, mostly defense contracting. I started back in 2003 and I got my PhD close to the time when Dustin did, actually, in 2017, because I was just working in the field and doing my PhD alongside for years. But a lot of the things that I have done have been about autonomous agents. Agentic AI isn't really new. It's just kind of being rediscovered, I think. Mm-hmm. And autonomous agents that act in environments like video games at first was a thing that we did. Warcraft 2 was one of the early domains that I worked on agents in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've made agents that play chess, that play Unreal Tournament. A whole different range of things, and having environments where you can act and you know, get better at things has always been really interesting to me, to find things that can interact with us on a really clear level where they understand the consequences of their action. And that's really blown up a lot.
Mm-hmm.
With conversational AI, there are a lot more domains where an agent can understand the consequences of its actions because they can understand.
And when you were working on these agents, were they LLM based, or this was like pre-LLM?
Yeah, very pre-LLM. So LLMs, I first learned about deep learning in, I think, 2016. That might be about right. And that was sort of a precursor technology to what we think of as LLMs now, or foundation models. You know, ChatGPT, does anybody know when ChatGPT came out? It feels like a COVID thing.
Yeah,
you can't really tell, right? It's like
the before times, before ChatGPT.
Yeah.
When was it? 2022?
I think end of 2022.
Okay.
Yeah.
When it hit the first public release?
I think that was the first open to the public.
Yeah. Pretty big moment. What did that feel like for you? I mean, you've been in the industry for so long, and then suddenly the public is obsessed with AI seemingly overnight.
I got to tell you, at first I hated it. So
common reaction.
Well, to me, so I've worked for years on explainability stuff and sort of neural networks, which is the technology which a lot of all LLMs are based on at some level, is fundamentally a technology that is black box.
Mm-hmm.
What worries me about that kind of technology is that it's not as governable, is a word that we use a lot these days, but it's harder for it to be transparent, or I feel like we don't, sorry, I'm not talking into the microphone as much. So I have worked on technologies that are much more understandable,
mm-hmm.
and that a person can really explain their goals to and know that those goals are being followed.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted that to be where
mm-hmm.
the first, you know, really general and interesting AI that everybody, you know, wanted to use for everything came from. And I was really disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
that neural networks got there first.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, over time, I have come to find lots of different ways where we can make these things work together and sort of I think we've come to understand better what the strengths and weaknesses of these different technologies are, and you know why maybe these things are good for language and good for, I guess, very unstructured data. Whereas I still want to use a lot of stuff that works with structured data, but it's more it needs to be at a higher, more abstract level. And abstraction is something that Dustin and I have worked on a lot in AI.
Nice. One of the things that we've talked about in the past couple episodes is it's not necessarily either or we've talked about, you know, world models and LLMs and or deterministic and non-deterministic, and that rather than just choosing, you know, one type of AI and going all in on that, that there's maybe synergies where the LLM is particularly suited for something and then other types of AI is suited for something else, and then they can kind of work together to get the best of both worlds. Is that something you think makes sense, or do you have a view there?
Absolutely. I really believe it. A world model fundamentally is a structured representation that is made through interpretation. And interpretation is something that LLMs are much, much better at in terms of interpretation of structured data. And the human brain does a lot of this stuff. Our senses take unstructured data and make structured representations inside. At least that's what we kind of think is happening, right? And then there are parts of our minds, you know, the conscious parts in particular, that I think are really good at manipulating these more structured things and making creative use, manipulating them in ways that are less, I want to say, so the word I want to use is inductive, and I don't know whether everybody's going to understand what I mean by that. So when we have things that learn through a lot of repetition, a lot of examples, then they sort of figure out what the median of something is. And you see when you use LLMs that they're going to tend toward, you know, what lots of humans are doing. This is good in, you know, being able to sort out these unstructured representations. But when you're working with a structured representation, like a world model, then you can extrapolate better. You can go outside the bounds of, you know, what is in what is most common, and you can start to make predictions. What would happen if we did something fundamentally different? And that's what science is about, to a large extent, is, you know, pushing the boundaries, figuring out, well, what haven't we tried yet? And, you know, technology, invention, all of this stuff, I think, is sort of based on this ability to think, I mean, I guess outside the box is one way to put it, but to go beyond the boundaries of what is common. And I think that the world models, the kind of goal reasoning that Dustin and I have worked on, they're good for doing that in a way that LLMs aren't necessarily.
Super interesting.
I mean, the way I feel about it is we didn't really have very general AI components before, in a sense. Like, you know, we've been working on this for a long time. We've made really powerful systems, but in some ways they were always a little brittle, you know? If there was a little mistake in a certain place, or, you know, it wasn't typed in a certain way, or you couldn't even have free form entry where you could kind of talk to it or have a user ask a question. You might even have like structured parts of questions you could ask. Or if it did look like natural language behind the scenes, it was really like a bunch of hacks to get it to be structured. So now we have this very general, it's much more flexible in general, because it's kind of learned these general patterns. But in some ways that also, you know, sometimes you want flexibility and generality, and sometimes you want proofs and guarantees. You want to know that if you are about to deploy this to go achieve something, it's going to do what you want, not what you don't want. And so I think that's the thing is where, and the other thing about this is that, so these generative AI models are trained from unstructured data. And that is really great for figuring out representations of the world, like kind of, you know, creating some kind of understanding. But then when you want to go use it, right? Uh-huh. When you want to act in the world,
right?
Which, by the way, a book is not the world.
It's not. It's my world.
I mean, a computer file system where you can run and execute code is also not the world.
Right.
And so the thing is that what all these people are finding, what language is so good for, it's just not necessarily the same. You can't just like take that immediately and go use it to run agents in the world.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it makes me think about, you know, how a lot of, programmers went into this line of business because of all the complexities and nuance that goes with communicating with humans. Whereas the beauty of at least the way code used to work is it is entirely unambiguous what things mean. And
at least if you wrote it, if somebody else wrote it, then it might be very ambiguous.
It might be ambiguous, but to the compiler, it's unambiguous.
Yes.
Right? Like interpreting why did they write this code is ambiguous, but it is this subset of language where we've kind of defined it down to have this exact action or result. Whereas when we're programming with an LLM, we don't have any idea with any kind of certainty what that result is going to be. And all the complexities of dealing with human beings, which is there's misunderstandings, there's nuance, and semantic meaning is inherently open-ended. So like we see this, for example, with prompt injection, where people try to filter it, and then there's just a way to rephrase it or re-encode the meaning in a different way. And it's hard to constrain that entire space. Or situations where the AI will achieve the benchmark by, you know, hacking the machine and faking the result or something like that, where now you're dealing with English, you're dealing with meaning, and you're saying accomplish this goal, and you have to then think about, well, how is that going to be interpreted? And there's many ways it can be interpreted. So it's both the kind of greatest strength is that it has this open-endedness to it, where it's general and you don't have to know in advance, like some big, you know, if branch tree for every possible thing that can happen. But on the other hand, we introduce this kind of unpredictability into the system at the same time.
I'll say it's just been wild to the last few years coding, especially coding a production system that touches users. When you have to have a function call that is non-deterministic, oh my God. I mean, you know, and by, you know, what I mean by that is whenever you call an LLM API. So it's in some ways it's gotten better, and there's these tools to like refine prompts, and you can try setting temperature equals to zero, but I actually caught one of the, I actually was kind of even getting blamed for something not working, but it was like a rare bug that was happening. It would only happen, honestly, like it only happened every couple weeks or something. And I was sure that I was literally running evals, everything. And I was sure that the model provider was doing something funny.
Right.
Temperature was zero. And you know, temperature being zero is not a guarantee that you're going to get the same thing. But, you know, most of the time it would work. And that's kind of one of the best controls you had if you're not running the model yourself. Or you can't like set other parameters. So, but anyway, one day I finally got hard proof. I got like hard traces of calling this model provider with the same thing and getting different answers back.
Interesting.
And I was mostly happy because I was like going insane. I was like,
right. I mean, I've been seeing this a lot on X recently, and I feel like I've been seeing it over the last few months, but it seems like it's kind of increasing in intensity, where people are convinced that Anthropic dumbed down the model, or they quantized it, and Opus 4.6 isn't the way it used to be a month ago. It's not as smart. maybe they need more compute for Mythos or whatever. I've seen similar accusations. A lot of times when new models drop, whether from OpenAI or Anthropic, there's like this kind of honeymoon phase where everybody's mind is blown. And then people insist they dumbed it down. And it's really hard to know what, if is that happening or is that some kind of human hallucination? And another wild card factor, at least I found in my own coding, is like, even if the model's exactly the same, the way I approach the model in a coding session might be different if my mood is different. So the language I use, the words I input into the machine are going to change based upon how I change. And that's another kind of non-deterministic factor. So how much of this is people are got a good result, then they got frustrated, then they get in a bad mood, then they start like yelling at their AI, then their AI starts spinning out? Or how much is it that Anthropic is actually doing this or some combination of the both? And like, it's another example of how this, the open-endedness and the non-determinism creates a lot of confusion about what the system's actually doing.
I have a hypothesis here. You mind if I talk?
Please jump in. Yeah, yeah.
So every time you retrain a model, you are fundamentally getting a different hypothesis about a connection between language and meaning. I think that each of us, each person you know, has a model of some kind in their minds that is connecting language to meaning. But we don't all have the same one. And that's what creates gulfs in communication, in part. There's probably more to it than that. When that shifts, it's fundamentally like you're talking to a different person. To the extent that we anthropomorphize these tools like Claude, we think of, you know, it as being reliable, like we make a relationship with it. And you know, when they introduce a new model, really it's like somebody went through a fundamental change. They're not the same person they were before. And you know, it's going to be fascinating at first. You seem to have gone away and learned all this new stuff, but you know, as you talk with them more, you're gonna say, well, I miss things.
Yes.
It is, I mean, you can go too far in anthropomorphizing this stuff. But I don't actually think it's necessarily the wrong thing to do, because LLMs are like humans in a lot of important ways, in the way we process meaning and we share meaning with one another. And so thinking of it as, you know, another person with a viewpoint is correct, I think. That there is a viewpoint inherent in the way we process language. You know, linguists, I think, talk about something called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, right? Where the words you have access to, the language you have, influences how you think. I think that we're seeing that with these agents, and that regardless of how much Anthropic is doing to put something on top of the model that makes it easier for people to use and changes how it works, when they retrain the model, they don't have the power to ensure that it's going to give the same experience, because it already thinks differently every time you retrain it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think I've heard certain people refer to it as like growing a model. Like there's almost like this organic process to it. And
it has the complexity of an organic process. And it has the, I want to say epiphenomenality. I don't know how, whether the word epiphenomenon is particularly recognizable, but
great,
you know,
word.
People know about fractals and stuff like that, how you get emergent properties from something that grows from little bits. And I think that's the organicness that we're talking about there. Mm-hmm. That it is sufficiently complex in its small rules that the whole picture is unpredictable. It looks very different.
And we can't, I mean, at least this is what I've heard from other people, that, you know, if you try to go in its brain and look at the weights and understand like how it's doing what it's doing, or, you know, the specific models or logical constructions, like it's not totally transparent to us either. And that would also kind of, I think, maybe contribute to that sense of that it's something that's grown, or it's something that we can't fully predict how it's going to behave. Mm-hmm. And to your point about personalities, you know, I remember, I think this happened with 4.0, where it was like,
yeah,
particularly,
this was a big deal for a lot of people. They were very emotionally, I think, upset.
It was very sycophantic, and people got really attached to it. And then I think some of the OpenAI engineers were saying like 4.0 was a mistake. It's like creating all this AI psychosis. Like, we never should have put it out there. And then they added a new one and they got rid of 4.0. And then all the 4.0 people freaked out and they added it back. But it is like, whether you anthropomorphize it or not, or whether you think of it as, you know, alive or not, it feels to it creates an illusion of an other that has a personality that you develop a relationship with. And if suddenly that personality shifts, or its brain, you know, its brain changes and you're used to relating to it, it can be very jarring. And I think this is why I'm really bullish on open weight models, because I want to have a model where I don't have to wonder, like, did it change, right? It changes when I decide it changes, and I get to choose the weights or fine-tune them or switch the model when I want. And nobody can, you know, tell me, oh, you know, you shouldn't use 4.0 anymore because it's bad for you or whatever. You know, if I like the way it's relating, it stays that way until I decide to change it.
And I think, I mean, there are a lot of problems with, you know, at this stage, we're still very early on in understanding how people will use conversational AI over the long term. And I think that one of the problems with having a lot of it controlled by these private companies at the moment,
mm-hmm.
Is, you know, there's a lack of transparency. There's a lack of understanding of what is part of the trained model and what isn't. And there's a lack of security fundamentally, in that if you want the good performance, you have to give up the certainty that it's in your sphere of control where the information is going.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that over the long term, open models, local models will become the norm.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, we have not gotten to the point where that is efficient enough, or I guess really, really practical. But it seems like everybody wants that, right?
I think so, yeah. I mean, as we get more dependent on these systems and we put more and more private and intimate information in them, it's really across at least those two dimensions, right? That it's like, you know, if I'm using this thing as my therapist, I don't exactly want everybody to know that. Or even as a lawyer, like I saw, you know, people use ChatGPT as a lawyer, and then all of those conversations are subject to discovery in court because there's no attorney-client privilege.
And talk about a backfire. Oh my God.
Can I do this? No, it's illegal. Can I do this? No, it's illegal. And then it's like, okay, so what? And then, you know, if you don't follow the AI and you do something else, and then they might be able to say you knew it was illegal.
Crazy. Or you're, you know, all these ways of interpreting the intention of the contract or the circumstance or your motivation or everything else is now available, you know, in litigation. I mean, there's just countless examples of this. And so I think for that reason, there's going to be a big desire, whether for individuals or businesses that want to have control over their data. But then the other thing about kind of I think anything that we grow really dependent on there's a natural desire to have control over it.
Yeah.
Because you just feel vulnerable where you're like, if this thing was taken away all of a sudden, like, you know, I'm lost in the world. You know, imagine after 10 and 20 years of us using AI every single day, and then all of a sudden it's taken away from you. Like your ability to work in the economy, or who knows what kind of downstream impacts that would have. So I think as it becomes something that is so essential to human life, humans want to have control and possession and ownership of something that is so essential to how they live.
And rights. I mean, an editor friend of mine, Catherine Forrest, was recently posting about how there are court cases right now about what is copyrightable. If you work with an LLM to generate content, and it really matters, I think, how you're doing it, right? If you ask it to write something and you put that out, then it's definitely not copyrightable, I guess. Mm-hmm. If you write something and ask it to revise it, yeah, that's copyrightable. If you you ask it to write something and then you edit it, then your modifications are copyrightable, right? So I think people don't understand their rights with respect to it. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I mean, I don't know what the right answer is, what these things should do in the future, but fundamentally to me, it feels like people are using it as a tool and they expect that if they do something with it, mm-hmm. they put their credibility behind it, mm-hmm. they should be able to treat it as theirs.
Sure.
And I think there's a strong argument there. I also think that people shouldn't just put things out from an LLM without reading and considering whether they really believe them, which a lot of people are doing right now. And it's problematic.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody is willing to stand behind something and nobody else, you know, bothered to take the time to decide what it should be, I mean, that is a product of them.
I mean, it's the verifier step, right? So in a, even like the way these things are trained or
yeah.
or in or at least in post training and other things, there is this notion of the verifier. Like you need some end thing, human something, some function to say this is success or this is true or this is useful and this is not. Because with these things, you can generate infinite amount of copy and text and marketing and all of that. So even if it is just simply you choosing this one out of 5 or 10 or 100 or 1,000 samples that's generated, that alone is a very, in some ways, that's the most valuable special capability because, like, fundamentally, it cannot do that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'd love to dig into the case law on this a little bit because it makes me think about other examples. Like if I take a paintbrush and I create like a machine where it just spins around and I'm trying to create some kind of like Jackson Pollock thing, which is like streaks mm-hmm. of paint, right? And I just hit the go button and it does that and I hit stop. Is that not copyrightable art because I used a machine to spin a bunch of paint around?
And does it matter who created the machine? And
I think it's you pressing the stop button when you decided to press the yeah. stop button and you deciding whether or not to even take it and do anything else with it.
Right. And but how is that any different than an LLM? Because I'm deciding to, I put the prompt in, right? I may have a few back and forth decide like when it's done. Mm-hmm. And so where does the line come in?
Right.
If we think about using tools or automation or machines or robots assisting in the process of creating something, where do we draw that line? Because in a way, it's almost as if people are kind of mythologizing the LLM. Like it's just this like magical AI box, and so the normal rules don't apply.
Someone should name a new LM mythos, mythical, myth, yeah, something myth based.
Right? AI box right there. No editing necessary.
Yeah,
just the full thing.
But maybe like operating system plus myth. So there's something there, I think. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. But I think William S. Burroughs in Naked Lunch, there was something where he like cut up a bunch of pages of something and like randomly rearranged them. Mm-hmm. Is that not copyrightable? I mean, that seems like a very artistic expression. So, I'm curious in these copyright cases, how these nuances are getting adjudicated and where the judges are drawing the line, and if there is principled, informed reasons, or if it's kind of the early state of the law here, and by the time it hits the Supreme Court or higher courts, that maybe they're going to come to a different conclusion about this.
I would suspect that it would change over time, but I am really not an expert on the law, and I'm just, you know, talking half-assed about something that I read online that was filtered through a friend of mine. But
that's what we're all about here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that it's really interesting, and it's important where these rights decisions land. And that process is always messy, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's another big legal, I love to nerd out on legal stuff because I used to be a lawyer. So there's a case, I mean, there's all these lawsuits, oftentimes very tragic circumstances where a teenager commits suicide after talking to a chatbot or these kinds of things. And so these companies are getting sued left and right. And one of the arguments that is being mounted in court is that the LLM speech is protected under the First Amendment. And what's interesting there is not, because at first it sounds like, oh, the AI has First Amendment rights to speak, which is a little dubious. But that's not actually the argument. The argument is that the First Amendment also protects the right to hear speech. The listener has First Amendment protection. So if there's speech in the marketplace, however it was produced, if I want to hear it and the government is getting in the way of that, that's a violation of my First Amendment right. And so they are situating this in that theory where they're saying, the person who wants to hear the chatbot, they have a right to that. And you could imagine kind of what the consequences might be if the case law goes the other way, if the government has the power to pass a law that says what your chatbot is allowed to say or not allowed to say. I mean, first there's like the technical problem of no one really knows how to implement that. But also, we're going to get these ridiculous laws where it's going to be like, you know, your AI is not allowed to tell you that this policy or this politician makes sense, you know, or every politician in the world is going to want to get their fingers in there and say, you know, for safety or for the children, the AI has to say this or can never say this. And that to me seems like, at least in violation of the spirit of the First Amendment, that when we think about the marketplace of ideas and freedom of thought, that it kind of seems inappropriate for the state to be dictating that. But I think that's another place to watch to see how the law plays out with these issues.
I mean, one thing I feel about this is, you know, this is kind of early technology. It's very powerful. You know, there's been a lot of hype. I mean, you have to generate. I mean, if you want to get the word out there and get people excited, you've got to hype things up. And at the same time, it's early technology. It's new technology. There's inherent, you know, limits on it. There is the disclaimer, right? That like it can make mistakes. Maybe that should be elaborated on. Yeah, it's kind of just a delicate thing. And I also just wonder like where personal responsibility comes into this. I guess is this mostly an issue because of people who are under 18?
I think that is where the majority of the issue is right now. And I think that's at least the strongest case you could make is to say, you know, minors, you know, don't have access to the full spectrum of rights. Although there is case about, you know, minors do have First Amendment protection to some extent. But I think, you know, if it only applies to minors, the impact on the broader underlying policy concerns of the First Amendment are not as impacted as if it applied to everyone.
Okay.
So, yeah, but you know, I think all these different nuances and distinctions are gonna play themselves out in the courts to see where they draw the line. But yeah, there's gonna be, you know, another situation could be, you know, what if somebody uses an AI to hack into something or build a virus or whatever? Like, should the company that created it be responsible? And this kind of relates to what we were alluding to before, Mythos.
Yeah.
So Mythos is the new Anthropic model that apparently is too dangerous to release to the public. And you know, people are accusing Anthropic of overhyping.
Yeah.
And some people are saying, hey, you know, I took an open weight model or open source and I pointed it at the same code base and I found all these 0 days and I didn't need Mythos to do it. But on the other hand, like the benchmarks that they're publishing do seem like a step function up from before. So, you know, can we discount it completely? I'm just kind of curious what you guys think. Like, is it real? Is it overhyped?
I mean, the funny thing is, yeah, I'm just thinking about this right now, but did they have to announce it the way they did? Like, what if in an alternate timeline, they just didn't say anything publicly about Mythos? They still had the private meetings with all the top companies, let them know, almost like the way you would disclose any kind of security issue, right? And maybe they're like, well, not only did we find these, we actually built a system we think will find even more or could run it. And, you know, they could just be offering that as a private service or all those things. So, you know, you got to wonder why make all the buzz around the, you know, just telling everybody, you know, you're not going to release it to them. So it's not like you're, or maybe this is, right? But, you know, these days, right? Isn't it all about going viral? Like anything you can go do to go viral. And that alone, I think, is why we've talked about like Doom and like, you know, P-Doom and like AI and, you know, fear of the future that somebody, you know, I wonder that you read a new headline about, you know, when things are going to get bad. Like there's all these predictions about specific years or you hear all this stuff. I wonder if that's just so engaging. I mean, you see this, anything that kind of baits you to have like fear or anger, this is what the social media algorithms are using to like keep you scrolling and keep you engaged. So I almost wonder if it's just trying to get attention, like that's the new marketing. Like you just marketing via getting your audience to feel negative emotions is, you know, tempting or at least seems to have initial high metrics, which you can then show and be like, hey, it's working. We're getting more attention and more people are talking about our company and can use our product. And
yeah, I guess that's just the way business is done these days, you know, get people really
kind of hope
upset
there's an alternative.
And cash in.
I think there's maybe another thing on it. Just Anthropic recently has had all the press about, you know, not wanting the U.S. to use their stuff for war, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they have clearly some kind of desire to appear ethical. And that may well be based on a desire to be ethical at some level. And, you know, any business is just so many moving pieces that often get out of sync with one another that it's quite possible that the people who want to be ethical and who want to appear ethical are different people. So it makes me think that this is messaging not just that they are, dangerous sounds like power. And I think we're focusing on this idea, are they trying to sound powerful? I'm thinking, what if they're trying to sound ethical? What if they're trying to sound like they care where the other guys don't?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not entirely certain that a business at a certain size can care.
Right.
You're just so at the whims of the market.
They're definitely virtue signaling at some level, I think.
Yeah.
Right? And I think it's important. And, you know, I think I wish other companies would virtue signal more, if only because it creates an incentive not to be total assets all the time.
Right. Yeah. Even if you're not doing it for the right reasons, as long as you, you know, arrive there, it doesn't really matter how you got there. If there is, you know, I mean, if we're in a world where the most profitable thing is to do the most ethical thing, I think that would be a pretty nice place to end up, even if the motives aren't pure. But yeah, I think that's kind of been Anthropic's shtick from the very beginning, you know, when they broke off from OpenAI, is they're kind of the more ethical, more, you know, conscientious. That's how they've been trying to define themselves and define their brand. But there's a dark side to that as well, which is they're constantly pushing centralized control. Mm-hmm. We need more regulations. The government needs to. It's kind of funny because on the one hand, they're saying we better not sell this stuff to the Pentagon. On the other hand, hey, the government better take over everything or, you know, the world's going to end. So which one is it exactly? I'm not sure. But
whenever anybody says ethical or even governance, and I'm hearing a lot of conversations about AI governance, I have to wonder who's ethics, right?
Yeah.
Because it matters a lot. I've been doing work on human alignment and ethics over the last few years. And, you know, one of the ways in my research we approach this is to say, okay, I'm going to take a person and look at their individual preferences and try to make the same decision that person would, because that person is at least somewhat consistent, right? Whereas if I want to look at humanity's ethics, they're all over the place, right?
Sure.
So is it the ethics of, you know, making money for your stockholders, which is what, you know, a lot of businesses even, you know, say, they say that out loud. It's not even the quiet part at all.
Right.
Or, you know, is it the ethics of, you know, freedom and to do what you want with your data? Your rights to, you know, right to privacy, right to use the things that you've purchased, when we talk about, you know, software rights and stuff like that. And different people clearly, I mean, so a person's right to use the music that they purchased is clearly bumping up against the company's right to charge for the music they own, right?
Totally.
Whose right wins in these situations? There isn't actually a clear ethical answer, and just saying that something is ethical doesn't actually mean that you agree with it or it's in your best interest.
Right, 100%. And, I mean, there's the category of people where they're not thinking about ethics at all, and, you know, it's cynical, or if they talk about it, it's disingenuous. They're pretending to be they're pretending to care about it, but they don't. There's like that bucket of people. Then there's the bucket of people who genuinely do care or are trying to think about ethical, what's ethical. But within that bucket, like you're saying, that doesn't mean that that person's ethics is your ethics.
Right.
And there's that saying, you know, the road to hell is paved in good intentions. Good intentions aren't enough.
Right.
It's not enough for Anthropic or whoever to say, we want to do the right thing. There's no guarantee that something really bad isn't going to come out of their desire to do what's good. And so, and you know, oftentimes in these safety arguments, that's what we see, right? So like after September 11th, the Patriot Act is put in. And, you know, you could say one group of people who tried to do that maybe were cynical. They just want more power. They don't really think it, you know, is for safety or whatever. And then there's another bucket of, you know, national security people that are genuinely concerned about terrorism and, the safety of the American public. And in the name of safety, we could easily lose all of our rights and have a totalitarian state. And somebody can make a very powerful ethical argument for it to say, these freedoms are putting us in danger and we have to, you know, get rid of them for the greater good. And they might really believe that, and maybe they might be right. So, you know, that is kind of at play with this stuff. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with Tristan Harris. He's been, he was one of the people in, I think he worked at Facebook, and he was in this social network documentary and kind of a very powerful voice about how social media is used to monetize people's attention and you know, that there was some unethical uses of it without even, you know, trying to be ethical. But now he's sort of pivoted to AI, and he has this organization, and he goes around, he's like, was in the AI documentary, and I heard recently about a talk he gave, because he's kind of like a celebrity in some circles, and you know, he's given, and he has these very dire predictions about AI. You know, even in this AI documentary, the documentarian was asking him, like, are you going to have kids? Like, should people have kids? And he was like, I don't know. You know, the world's going to end in 10 years. Like, really extreme.
Oh my God.
And people, what I heard is, he was giving this talk, and people in the audience are crying and getting really upset and in deep despair because they believe what he's saying. And then he's telling these people, that's how you should feel. And it's they're literally have this campaign they're going to do. They're going to put all these billboards up and all of this stuff, like the kind of anti-smoking campaigns, but it's going to be like an AI thing to shock people, make people upset, make people afraid. And of course, the solution that they're prescribing is, you know, call your senator and, you know, get the government to do something about it, to the point that I almost wonder if he's like an intelligence operative that's like trying to corral everybody into this. But like, I think that is really scary to me when there are people out there who want people to be in despair because and not to have hope, because I think that's incredibly disempowering, and it literally causes people to give their power away when they're in that state.
Yeah, you literally cannot make good decisions.
Right.
I mean, whenever you do something when you're angry or you're afraid, in the long run, if you look back, that decision ends up not being a very good decision, right?
Absolutely.
A lot of times people make decisions to, I don't know, stay at their job or stay in a bad relationship out of fear. And then, you know, later they look back and they absolutely feel so.
Right.
And it's also like, you have you ever done that exercise where you like count how many circles you can see in the room?
No.
So there's this exercise where you could take 30 seconds and look around the room and count how many circles. And what you'll notice is there's so many other things you did not see.
Huh.
So what you're thinking and what you're feeling colors your whole experience and all of your work and ends up being what you produce. So it's almost, it's where you get into this self-fulfilling prophecy. And this is why, you know, healthy habits and meditation and, I mean, talk about getting out of AI psychosis, you know, like you got to step back and clear your mind, clear your emotions.
Right.
Especially now more than ever, because especially now we're in a world where information and perspective is the battleground. Like I hate, you know, and maybe it's been like this for a while, but it's even more so. And it's not even us, it's the agents, right? I mean, you know, it's not even SEO anymore, it's AEO. It's like, if people are going to ChatGPT, how are they talking about your product? So now it's, we're just living in this massive, like, weighted cloud of, like, information, you know, information agendas. And so it's so hard to think clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been saying this last couple episodes, I feel like going on certain websites or social platforms is just straight up adversarial.
Right.
Like, I want to surround myself with what I'm calling the agentic aura, which is like, I want all information filtered through my own local, to use your term, fiduciary agents.
Right.
That are like, for me, to help me have more clarity and help me have like happier state of mind, more relaxed state of mind, because then I'm more powerful. I can achieve more. I'm more efficient. And also life is just better.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's really true. Like when you go on, when you log onto the internet or social media, you're immediately subject to countless psychological operation campaigns, quite literally, you know, whether it's by intelligence agencies, private actors, individuals,
businesses,
advertising, tracking,
yeah,
all of it. It's all trying to control your mind, get you to do something, get you to think something. Mm-hmm. And it is highly adversarial. And I think that's one of the big reasons where you get a weird feeling when you're done logging off.
Yeah.
You know, you don't feel good. You kind of feel on some level that your mind just got like extracted or manipulated, and you don't feel whole. You don't feel connected to your humanity and other people's humanity. A lot of times people feel depressed or in a bad mood or, you know, all of these things.
I don't think it's new in the sense that for thousands of years, people have been using narratives and trying to control people through fear, through being able to influence what they believe, not trying to get too controversial, but certainly there are some religions which have been exploited, at the very least, to attempt to control and gain power quite successfully, and authoritarian governments. I think that what has changed is the ability to craft a message and deploy it much more effectively in the past. If people are all kind of looking at the same places.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always really important, I think, to look at the incentives. So for OpenAI and Anthropic, they have an incentive to get you to use their tools. So if they tell you that something is governable and everybody seems to actually think this is possible at the moment, it's because they want you to believe that it's governable, so you'll use it. My point of view, it's a black box. You don't know what its motivation is. There is no way for most, you know, for any LLM to be governable. It's total snake oil. At the same time, if you don't give it power, then it can't do something to you. I mean, you interact with people all the time. You don't govern the people you interact with. I don't know why you expect to be able to govern the LLM. But I'm not saying don't use it, and I'm not saying be scared of it, because, you know, you don't give out your social security number and your credit card number to everybody. Because, you know, you're willing to trust them with a certain amount of power over you. Don't give the LLM power over you. Certainly, I mean, if anybody out there is putting an LLM in charge of missiles or nuclear codes, I have a big beef with them. But the fault is not the LLM. I used to have a boss who liked to say, if the king gives a sword to a monkey and the monkey stabs him, it's not the monkey's fault.
Right.
And so anyway, we have extreme people who are saying, oh, this AI is great, trust everything. And people are over-trusting. We have other people who are saying, AI is terrible, don't use it at all, take it completely out of your life. They have incentives too. There are also people out there who are under-trusting. And, you know, years worth of media that focuses more on evil AI like the Terminator rather than good AI like Data from Star Trek tends to bias people. And I've always thought that it's all in how you use it. But pay attention to, you know, if you see an extreme narrative, then somebody's got an extreme incentive. And I don't know. Fear mongering is, you know, a thing on one side, but the seductive promise of new technology is kind of the opposite to me, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where everybody says, I'm going to use LLMs for everything. I'm going to write my emails to my friends with LLMs. I mean, you don't need to do that.
They might stop being your friends.
Do you really want to save time talking to your friends? I don't know.
Get back to Vibe Coding.
That's right.
Which is disappointing in some ways because we love working with these really explicit, non-ambiguous languages, right? I say, and I don't think that all work with Claude Code is Vibe Coding, but I am disappointed that in order to be efficient, I have to use it these days in some ways, but I'm also elated that I am incredibly productive, right?
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, there are downsides, but...
Yeah, I mean, I just worry about, like, how when people talk about, oh, we're worried about not being able to govern the AI, that in some ways that's a cipher for we're worried about not being able to govern the individual. You know, that they're actually want to control humans. And if we give these AIs to humans and we can't control the AI, then we can't control the humans. And so we need to have these guardrails and it needs to be centralized and, you know, only the big tech companies can get Mythos and, you know, the plebs. We couldn't give it to the plebs because imagine what they would do. And behind all of this is this institutional bias, whether it's the government needs to take over or the big tech companies need to take over. But none of these voices are saying, actually, what we need to do is push the power to the individual, and the institutions are the danger. Centralization is the danger. That is a perspective that is underrepresented. You know, I saw this new AI doc, which is a really good documentary. I recommend seeing it. And they had this very wide range of perspectives from the extreme pessimists, the extreme optimists, people in the middle. But nobody had the viewpoint of the danger is actually centralization and we have to push this to the individual. We have to decentralize it. That wasn't represented at all, which I thought was very surprising.
The people with the money, their viewpoints are the ones that are getting heard, right? The danger of centralization, I think, is kind of the concern of the little guy who isn't well organized enough. And it doesn't fit, you know, the contrary viewpoints of any of the people with the big money. So they just don't talk about it.
Right. Or they make it seem really dangerous. They're like, that's the last thing we would ever want to do.
Yeah.
You know, is let the individual get access to this. And it kind of reminds me of maybe what, or makes me think about maybe what it would have felt like when the Gutenberg printing press was first invented and all the translations of the Bible were in Latin. And, you know, Tinsdale had one of the first translations of the Bible in English. And that is still one of the most influential works in the English language.
Mm-hmm.
But he was burned at the stake for that. And, you know, a lot of the arguments for the church was only the elite should be able to have direct access to this. And it's harmful for the average person to interpret it themselves. They're going to get all these bad ideas. The devil's going to get in their head. And it should all be mediated through the church to kind of deliver the safe, proper interpretation of the text. And in a lot of the debates today seem kind of like the same dynamic, just dressed up in new clothing.
You know what I feel like this is? We're not giving humans enough credit. I remember kind of from a very early age, when you started to get a bigger perspective of the world, I just felt like It's so amazing how almost everyone on the planet like gets along. And I obviously that might sound very naive. Of course, there's all these conflicts. There's, you know, in some ways, peace is very fragile. And there's always, but at the same time, it's incredible what we have on the planet. Like the fact that, you know, you walk into a grocery store and you see like the diversity of high quality goods, and you walk into like other, like in some ways, I mean, there's a lot of improvements to make, but I don't think people give the individual enough credit on the whole across all of humanity. And
I would actually go a little further. I would say that at least 99% of conflict is driven by centralized power dynamics. Even if you go down to people who are arguing about their sports team, right? There's a centralized power behind each of the different teams that is motivating them. That the things that are motivating them are not their problems themselves. I mean, occasionally people have problems with their neighbors, you know, fences being in the wrong place or something like that is the, you know, the archetypal example.
Right.
But they don't go to war. The only people who go to war are governments. And it's not, you know, all the major source of conflict in the world is I don't have enough power. I want the power that guy has as well. And, you know, yeah, I agree. Individuals are not the source of the problem. They never have been. It's the people who, you know, try to suck up all the power from the individuals so that they can be the vast determiners.
And just, you know, one more thing there is, you know, if you've looked into Bitcoin, Bitcoin has a very long-term view, right? I mean, literally in the white paper, it says the year 2140 is when the last thing will be mined. I mean, to build something and then have it, you know, you've set a date that's like 150 years in the future, or like 120, 30 years in the future,
right,
is like wild long-term thinking. There's an organization here in San Francisco. It's a really cool bar if you want to go to the Interval, but it's run by the Long Now Foundation. And I don't know too much about them, but I've been there it's a really cool spot if you haven't been there. But their whole thing is, how do we get humanity to think on such long time scales, like the next 1,000 years, 10,000 years. And I just see, if you want robust systems, decentralized is so much better. And, you know, we mentioned this before, but like, we take for granted all the decentralized systems in our life, right? Mm-hmm. Like you're like literally local and state governments is a form of decentralization. Your family and your house, like it's not like everyone in the whole country lives in one building. Right? It's very decentralized. Like, and so all of that makes for very resilient systems. And so I think if we want to build, you know, a future that is better for everyone, that works for more people, just decentralization in general is the goal.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I love the point you made about all the human goodness that's happening every single day, every single moment. When you think about all the cooperation that's happening all the time that is making the world go round.
It's all invisible. No one talks about it. I mean, it's like, dude, this would not exist. We couldn't be here. We wouldn't have to say, like, the amount of cooperation that happens in the... Oh, we just lost the light, I think. It got a little dark here as we're talking about positive.
I know, we're trying to raise the light, but...
yeah, yeah. But, you know, it's just, I feel like it's almost like a miracle. I think it's not that it's... Something obviously is going on where 99.9% of like people and individuals are good, and they want outcomes that work for not only themselves, but other people around them. And I think if that wasn't the case, it you know, maybe none of this would exist. Like we wouldn't be here.
There's no way, you know? And then, I mean, how many people not only are cooperating, how many people are sacrificing for somebody else every day, for somebody they love, somebody they care about, right? That's happening all the time. But that's not what we hear about in the news. And people get so cynical about human nature. Humans are bad. And a lot of it, I think, comes from looking at an individual's inability to solve something that they have no ability to solve on their own. So people will say, you know, no one cares about climate change, so people are bad. Or, you know, racism exists, so, you know, you're a bad person because you haven't solved racism, or you haven't solved climate change, or you're not doing enough to battle these, like, incredibly complicated problems that nobody has a great answer for. And there's no easy solutions. And meanwhile, you know, somebody's got their hands full just getting through the day and meeting their immediate responsibilities. But then we blame that individual somehow for climate change or for, you know, all the social problems. It's this bad individual doesn't care enough, isn't doing enough. And that also reminds me of tactics that have been used in religion where it's like, you're bad for being human. You're sinful, you're bad, and that is why you have to give me the power over you because you're no good. And it's a similar thing, you know, with this rhetoric about humanity is bad, the individual is bad, and therefore we need to take that power from the individual because they're not using it correctly. When so often the opposite is true, the individual is fine. like you were saying, it's these institutions or these large organizations or these groups where things start to break down. And even then, you can't even necessarily blame the individual because there are all these people in a corporation or in a government, and there's incentives and there's structure, and there's no one person that you can point to and say, it's their fault, they're the bad guy, they made the right decision, they made the wrong decision. A lot of it is just about system structure. But we want to, we love to find that bad guy. We want the villain. We want somebody to blame. We want to say it was their fault. They did the wrong thing for the wrong reason. And the more nuanced perspective where it's kind of, more about oftentimes the difficulty of the underlying problem. Like, I think a lot of times people think that, you know, there's somebody who, you know, when it comes to income inequality or climate change or any of these big issues, AI, you know, social media, there's somebody who is, has access to some lever where they could just make everything good and they're just choosing not to pull the lever. But like, I think usually when you like kind of unpeel what's going on, there's these crazy trade-offs and risks and uncertainties. And it's like, this lever has these risks and this one has these risks. And it's not because someone is like some evil person saying, I'm going to pull the give me all the money lever and kill everybody. You know, it's like they're kind of overmatched by the difficulty and complexity of the problem. And I'm not saying that's always the case. But it's kind of like that saying where it's like never attribute like malice to what you could attribute ignorance to.
Or incompetence.
Incompetence. Yeah. But I think there's like an even further one, which is never attribute incompetence to when you can attribute the difficulty of the underlying problem.
Well, so this makes me almost more hopeful than ever and a reason to be optimistic about the future, because if it is difficult problems and building systems, and then we are unlocking that with AI,
right?
I mean, that's just a perspective. Like, if we're all more intelligent, maybe we get way better outcomes in the future. That, but again, no one seems to be talking in this way,
right?
And so they don't. It's like you haven't even identified the problem that you should be focused on solving. And then if you don't even know the problem or that cause of the problem, you can't even see what it might look like if things were different.
I don't
really
know
if
this is what you're talking about when you talk about the centralization problem, but I do wonder if simple power distribution is, you know, one of the major problems with humanity, and that, you know, fundamentally, if power is distributed as evenly as possible, then you know, we have some theoretical minimum. I don't think it quite works, because I think I'm describing anarchy. at the end. And not that anarchy is necessarily bad, but certainly there is still violence that happens in anarchy. And but it feels like there is maybe the technology could be a force for even power redistribution, which is fundamentally, though, at odds with any governmental structure, which is, you know, fundamentally about centralized power.
Yeah, I think there's really something to that. And, you know, it's there's also a spectrum, right? Like, even within a government, like, let's say the U.S. government, like, having the branches of government is a way of trying to distribute power. And in general, there's this problem of power, which is power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that doesn't mean that the person who's corrupted by it is a bad person. Because anyone who has the weight of that power is probably not going to be able to bear it. The, you know, I'm kind of a Lord of the Rings nerd. Do you guys know, you know, Gandalf and that whole thing?
I mean, I'm a fan. I haven't gone too deep. I won't, don't quiz me on it, but.
Yeah, this is just an example I come back to a lot because I think it's a good analogy for this, which is, you know, Gandalf, who is sort of one of the like beacons of integrity in the story. You know, he's like one of the good guys. He's always like ethical, whatever. But when he puts the ring on, like in the Fellowship of the Ring, that scene at the beginning or in the books where he's like sitting near the fireplace, he's putting the ring on, and he starts to get corrupted by it, and he needs to get rid of it.
You mean Frodo? You mean the Bilbo?
Well, no, Gandalf. There's a moment
that's right,
where
that's
he's
right,
kind of
right.
Like they don't realize that the ring's there, and
they don't know what it is yet.
They don't know what it is
and
yet,
like,
and he's kind of like in this weird daze, like staring into the fire, and like you know almost has to push himself. You know, or that also happens to Galadriel, where she like puts it on. And she's like, oh, you know what I would do, and whatever. And she has to like stop herself. Where it's like there's almost a power where if you were given enough power, no matter how good you are, it would mess you up. And so I think of that in the context of checks and balances, or even something like Bitcoin, where it's like the power to create money is almost too much for the government to wield responsibly. And we almost have to like take that power away, not because the government's bad, but because that restores it to its goodness by not having the corrupting power. So that's another way of thinking about distributing power or decentralizing power or balance of power is that if we distribute it enough, then each person can kind of be responsible for the amount of power that they're given.
Right.
But if we concentrate it too much, it's very difficult for that to be wielded responsibly.
And that's sort of the ideal of democracy, which is, you know, never really realized, right, is that each citizen is really responsible for what's going on. And actually, it makes a better argument for the idea that everyone should vote than I've heard in the past, because I've tended to think that if you don't want to vote, you probably shouldn't. But if, you know, the more people who vote, the less concentrated the power is, maybe, you know, that's really good if everybody could take responsibility.
And then I have cared a lot about voting, and I, you know, I think not enough when people see outcomes of elections or other political things where they personally are not necessarily happy, or a group isn't happy. You know, I'm looking like okay, who all voted? Like, let's get at the what. You know, what was the process? And if you look at the voting numbers, they're so low. And I wonder, again, like, I think it can be easy to maybe blame different groups or the individuals themselves. But what if fundamentally it is a, like, complexity and information issue? I mean, I never really felt, you know, I was not in politics or even in any kind of, I didn't really study that a lot in school or like read a lot of that in my free time. I never felt fully up to speed on making a good decision or even what the, you know, looking at the evidence to say, you know, you can always easily hear what people say if you quickly look them up, but then to see, okay, well, what have they done in the past? You know, so much information. So that's again why, like, if we all level up because of AI, then, and we implement mechanisms like, you know, ranked choice voting looks very interesting, right? Mm-hmm. As a mechanism to make it so that candidates aren't so against each other because they kind of share votes at the end if they don't, the way that it works. So if we all level up with more, and we are literally more intelligent, we can process more information more quickly, then, and we have better cryptography everywhere that makes it secure and we can prove who we are without maybe revealing who we are, then, you know, like, why can't we digitally vote? And I can chat with an AI to say, like, I want the candidates that most align with my values, what I personally value.
Right.
Like, could that fix a lot of things? But again, that's another potential promise of everyone having AI.
Right. And having their own AI that is fiduciary, that is transparent, that is verifiable. Because otherwise, you know, because like, politicians always, you know, a lot of politicians lie or propaganda or whatever. So I would want an AI that can kind of like poke through the BS, you know, and tell me what's really going on. Look at their voting record. Look at who they're getting money from. Compare their rhetoric. Let's get to the ground truth. But if my AI is not allowed to tell me that because, you know, for the children or whatever, it can't tell me the truth. Then we don't get that benefit.
This is actually something that Dustin and I are working on a bit right now. There's a lens system that we proposed recently. The idea being that, you know, you collect evidence using LLM technology, which is really good at interpreting and finding all that stuff. But you combine it using something that's not an LLM, that is something you own, that's on your machine. That is using, you know, specialized rubrics based on your values.
Interesting.
To determine, you know, what is, what likely you should believe about whether this is something that's good for you. Do you think I'm describing that well?
Yeah, I think absolutely. But it's very much grounded in like evidence ranking and then how much evidence and how well that evidence scores against a particular rubric. But that you have control over the rubric or can try different, or other people can make rubrics.
And part of the reason why that will work is because while, you know, gathering information is based on the LLM technology that's centralized, the ability to combine the information is distributed and localized to the individual.
Ah. So is, could you walk through like maybe an example to just kind of make it more concrete?
So I think of it in terms of doing something like consumer reports. So say you're trying to figure out what car to buy, right? Not controversial. I mean, I suppose if I were in an auto conference, it would be, but anyway. So you need the LLM to go out and find the best information possible about, you know, the miles per gallon, the safety record, the maintenance record of a bunch of car companies, combine the information, find out what the best thing we have is about, you know, this model line, if that model line's been around a while. And it's going to try to find sources that are you know, not marketing copy, right? That are coming from people generally who are you know, consumer watchdogs, stuff like that, right? Going to pull that in, and the LLM is gonna find and search down all that information, and then on your computer, you're going to access that archive of information. Say, okay, I've got all this evidence about what these things are. Then I am going to apply my rubric. So what I am most concerned about is energy efficiency, and I'm also going to want to know how long, you know, how long my repair times are going to be, or something like that. And so, your local evidence-based reasoner is going to put together pro and con arguments for each of the different vehicles you could consider, saying, you know, this is the miles per gallon here. This is what your actual cost is, maybe even bring in information about, you know, what the energy, what type of energy is available to your house, you know, whether it's actually gas or solar or something else. Evaluate based on that, make those arguments up and tell you, scores based on what you want and your personal information, as well as the information gathered from the web. These arguments are fundamentally deductive. They are not, they're not linguistic. Mm-hmm. They're not, using the LLM mechanism of, guess what the next word is, right? Mm-hmm. They're instead...
And not even structured as a conversation, even necessarily.
Yeah, they're not necessarily structured as a conversation. They're, structured as a list of pros and cons and an evaluative number, for example. And then, you have something that's very personalized that is, non-bullshit.
or at least you can configure what you trust. So imagine you got all this evidence from all these sources, but yet for whatever reason, you distrust certain sources. You could just simply deselect those and see how it might change.
Uh-huh.
And that gives you more power too.
And so is there an LLM that is used at all for this part of the process?
No, not for the argumentation part.
Mm-hmm.
It's only used for searching the to find where the information is. It'll tell you what the source of it is, right?
Uh-huh.
And it'll tell you, what the numbers are and that kind of thing. And it could hallucinate, and we'll do things several times to make sure. But you could generally rely on the LLM to provide you,
mm-hmm.
Concrete data,
uh-huh.
More than you can to provide you an opinion, right?
I see.
You can also, maybe you have reviewers out there that you can rely on. Maybe you trust Consumer Reports. Fine.
Right.
It's still not really individualized to you. They have different priorities than you do. Right?
Sure.
This would be a way of accumulating that information and developing a personalized argument. It's not unbiased, but it's biased toward you. Right?
Right.
And the bias is transparent.
Sure.
So
the LLM gets the sources,
mm-hmm.
and then but there's some sort of qualitative evaluation of the content in the source or some scoring of it?
Yeah, well, we want to score the source in terms of, it's going to be domain specific in a way. So like if you're looking at cars, generally more miles per gallon is better
mm-hmm.
Than less, right? There's a natural ordering to the data that allows uh-huh. you to order that if it is a value. If it is, language, uh-huh. then you do need to have a way to say, this says a specific, there is a specific logical representation of this information.
Oh,
and I can chain these facts together in a deductive reasoning chain to come up with a particular conclusion. You can do that without, LLM's hidden bias.
That's fascinating. So do you use the LLM to structure the data from the unstructured data? Because it sounds
you do have to uncover the structure using an LLM. No natural language techniques that I'm aware of are strong enough to do that in general domain.
I see. So you're able to, you take some magazine article or whatever it found.
Right.
And then you can extract out, let's say, hard numbers.
Mm-hmm.
You can extract out logical arguments that are structured.
In fact, like when, individual sentences, if it says, this car is has been tested by the Automobile Mechanics Association, right? And you have a fact that is explicitly associated with that that's being asserted, right? So you say that
mm-hmm.
according to this source,
mm-hmm.
testing was performed here, and you know they're the people who were providing numbers, right? So that fact, then, if I want to construct an argument out of it, mm-hmm. I don't necessarily want to use the argument from the article. I want to use the facts from the article, and you know restructure the argument because I don't know if I can trust the way they have decided to put the information together,
right?
And, you know, I want to check to see whether I've got the same facts from a few sources as well. And I want to check, you know, in some cases, like, I don't want to trust Anthropic to tell me what's good about Claude. What I really want is to look at the source and see, does it do something that it claims it does, right? So that I can verify directly. Now, it's not open source, so I can't do that. And that is part of what makes it fundamentally less trustworthy mm-hmm. than an open source model. Open source models are fundamentally more transparent and we should give them less trust.
Absolutely. And is there, do you have like, is there like a symbolic language you use to structure an argument in a way that you can do that kind of like deterministic analysis?
Yeah, I mean,
analysis
you can use
over?
First order logic for it. There are a lot of logics that have been invented in the computer science literature. Mm-hmm. One that's particularly popular right now, it's called answer set programming. So it's a, have you ever heard of Prolog?
I've heard of it, yeah.
So
I've never
Prolog
used
is a declarative means of programming through logic. Answer set programming is more powerful than it in some ways. It allows abductive inference and it allows you to consider, I guess, the probabilities of various facts and put together an analysis, and there's great tools for searching for, you know, something that satisfies a number of characteristics. If you're familiar with the satisfiability problem in computer science, there's been a lot of headway made. And, you know, LLMs don't do this natively. They don't solve the satisfiability problem, partially because, you know, it's a computationally inefficient thing to do. Mm-hmm. But partially because it's not, it's easier in some ways to predict the next word. And people don't always use logic in their arguments, right? They use associations,
right?
You know, you argue by reference to authority, and stuff like that, rather than putting together the logic. I've spent a lot of time working with logical systems, and you know, I see that as a fundamentally unbiased, native way to put together facts. Right?
Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah, and there's all the logical fallacies, you know, slippery slope or Strawman, or you know, all of these things. And I think a large percentage of arguments or supposed arguments are subject to those fallacies that people mount. But that is a fascinating way of using the LLM that I had never thought about, to kind of take this unstructured data, put it into structure, and then even for reasoning, use this. Once it's structured in a way that the reasoning algorithm can understand, then you probably get, in some senses, a lot better reasoning. Because I think we've all seen LLMs make really ridiculous reasoning mistakes all the time, and it'll say, oh, we're going to do this because of X, and then you follow up and you're like, well, that doesn't really follow from X, and it's like, oh yeah, you're right, it doesn't follow at all. And it's like, you know, whereas if you have something like Prolog or something like that, that's not going to happen.
No, it can't make those kinds of mistakes. It also can't generalize and just suck in information and mount something without somebody spending a lot of time on it. So the generalization of LLMs is amazing, but the ability to be accurate, the logical groundedness isn't there. I mean, fundamentally, they're thinking the same way people think, which is messy.
Right.
I mean, it's not really exactly the same way people think, but it is messy like us. And English, right? We talked before about how There are ambiguous languages and unambiguous languages. Constructing an argument in the language of English arguments
right.
fundamentally does not have the guarantees
right.
that we get from logic.
And I just, amazing. You know, it might feel like we're talking about something like super cool, part of AI you've never heard about, but it's in a lot of ways analogous to writing code. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you're like why even bother writing any code? Like whatever you're writing the code to do, why doesn't the LLM just produce, or if it's a multimodal model, why doesn't it just produce that for you directly? Well, the reason is that you want to do something in a complex enough way, and you maybe care about certain guarantees or reliability, mm-hmm. and then you want to, you know, and if you can put it into this code language and then run it through a compiler, well, it's kind of, you know, I'm curious what you think about this, but you know, in some ways, it's kind of the same. It's just that instead of a compiler, you have these specialized like reasoning algorithms mm-hmm. Or inference algorithms, and a different kind of inference, not neural network inference. Mm-hmm. But then, and also there's a language. And so what's amazing is like, you know, I used to write these by hand mm-hmm. and oh my God, it was kind of like a painstaking, it was like extra hard programming. and the thing about answer set programming in general that I've heard, so it runs, it basically all comes down to a super optimized SAT solver. So SAT is this famous computational problem in, if you look at computational, like P equals
that's
NP.
That's the same as the satisfiability I referenced earlier.
Yes, yeah, same thing.
In case anybody
same thing,
is
yeah.
confused.
SAT. So there's been this ongoing work how to make more and more efficient SAT solving mm-hmm. because so many NP hard problems mm-hmm. can be translated into a satisfiability problem. And then if you can translate it, then you can run it on this highly optimized SAT solver to get the answer out.
Right. So an example of this that I ran into, I was working on, I work on key management systems, and I think about recovery flows.
Like keys for like the door?
Like getting your house. No, like, you know, let's say protecting your Bitcoin or protecting your AI data encryption keys. And you
or
have
SSH keys.
Or yeah, whatever cryptographic key that's like high value that you need to distribute it where you have like two of three can move funds or authorize an action. And I had this really hard problem where I wanted to have the system be robust to all of these different scenarios, like loss, theft, seizure, like every possible thing that can happen, which is really hard to kind of hit that bar. And so I had these, I had this set of, I think there was like eight authentication factors. Like there was like phone, hardware wallet, like a PIN-based key. There's like all these different keys. There's like eight different factors. And I wanted to create these sets where you could always lose two and still spend. And then I had other conditions where it was like, there should never be mobile only factors and like all of this different stuff. And I wanted to search through the entire space. And it was like the power set of eight or so. It was like some insanely huge number to brute force all the different ways of combining the factors into these sets and then analyzing all the sets if they collected them according to my rules and all of this stuff. And then that's when I discovered. I had never heard about SAT solvers. I was doing this research. It's like, oh, there's these SAT solvers, and you can encode the problem in this language, and they can actually like search through this space that you could never get through with a brute force. But they could search through this giant space, and I did that. I used the there was like a Google one, CPSAT or something like that.
I'm curious. Was there many answers, or was there kind of one answer?
No, that was what was crazy. It came up with like out of this huge, giant space, there was like five different configurations that actually satisfied the conditions.
That's wild.
It felt like
finding a gem or a needle in the haystack.
That's what it felt like. It was like this is the golden one, and it was like no wonder it's so hard. You know, I'm on the whiteboard trying to think through, like, mm-hmm. what if we did this and what if we did that? And I had no idea how doomed I was trying to do it that way because the space was so big and I was never going to find this, like, needle in the haystack. But anyway, that's, like, just a whole long detour just to provide an example of the power of a SAT solver that you can like search through this enormous space.
And you get strong guarantees or perfect guarantees almost for your problem.
Yeah, which is hugely powerful.
Yeah. Well, guys, should we kind of wrap up a little bit? We've been talking a little while and, it's been a pleasure having you here, Matt, and talking about all this stuff. I guess anything you guys want to...
Well, this has really got me thinking about using LLMs in this way of kind of combining them with these other types of reasoning systems. I think that's super fascinating. I think that also could be really important from a tokenomics perspective where, you know, who knows how expensive tokens are going to get one day. And if you can not use the LLM for every single thing that's happening in the system and kind of have a more targeted use, that could be interesting. But
it's often much more efficient as well, at least in the sense of, taking less computational power to come up with an answer. It doesn't necessarily... It might require you to spend more development effort to get working at an LLM, but for that, you generally get back some benefits in not needing so many GPUs to get stuff done.
So good for the environment. You're worried about water usage, you know, use Prolog or something like that. But yeah, no, it's absolutely fascinating. I'm going to be thinking about this. I really appreciate your insights about it.
Well, I've really enjoyed talking to you. This has been fun, guys.
Amazing. Awesome.
Yeah. Well, till next time, please like and subscribe and leave us a comment. And we'll see you next time.
Yeah. See you next time.